from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. The vaccine for HPV, human papillomavirus, has played a surprising role in Republican presidential politics in recent weeks, with candidate Michelle Bachmann attacking Texas Governor Rick Perry for his attempt to require that preteen girls receive the vaccination in his state. Now California may become front and center in the HPV debate. A little-notice bill now sitting on the governor's desk would allow children as young as 12 to receive the vaccination without parental consent. The debate over a vaccine and the role of parents. Next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. HPV, human papillomavirus, is transmitted sexually. It's extremely common and usually does no harm, but certain strains of the virus can also lead to cervical cancer. A vaccine to prevent HPV has received plenty of attention during recent Republican presidential campaign debates, from Texas Governor Rick Perry's attempt to require that all girls in Texas receive an HPV vaccine to Michelle Bachmann's claim that the HPV vaccine could be dangerous. But the debate over this vaccine isn't just an issue in Republican presidential party politics. A little-notice bill now sitting on California Governor Jerry Brown's desk could put California in the center of this debate as well. In California, a minor can obtain birth control and an abortion without parental consent. What they can't get on their own is the HPV vaccine. The bill awaiting the governor's signature or veto would change that and let girls as young as 12 receive certain preventative services without parental consent, including the HPV vaccine. We want to get our conversation started first with Assemblymember Toni Atkins. She represents the 76th District, which includes parts of San Diego, and is the author of AB 499, the bill that would provide the services that I just described. Toni Atkins, thanks very much for joining us this morning.
Well, thank you, and good morning.
Good morning. Tell us first why you wanted to get this bill to the governor's desk.
Well, I think it's an important issue of public health for young people. We know that human papillomavirus, or HPV, causes about 70% of the cervical cancers. And it's, you know, the prevalence of HPV has made it the world's second leading cause of death among women. So it's a public health issue, and California law already allows people, boys, young men, young women under the age of 18, the ability to get diagnosis of sexually transmitted diseases and allows them to get treatment. There is a gap in the ability for prevention, which HPV vaccines, hepatitis C vaccines, and prophylactic use of antibiotics for exposure to HIV are all considered prevention. And there is a gap in state law on prevention.
And how do you respond to the concern about parental rights, that this would allow young people as young as 12 to make these decisions independently without parental consent? Your response to concerns that that deprives parents of what is normally thought of as the key parental role?
Well, I think that what evidence has shown us is that most young people do include a parental figure, someone in their family in these decisions. But for those young people who are not able to do that for various reasons, you know, California has already had this discussion. We've had the discussion as it relates to young people being able to have access to diagnosis and treatment of life-threatening STDs. So we've already had this discussion. This just extends it to the issue of prevention, which in some ways is even more important than diagnosis and treatment once a young person is exposed. So Californians have had this discussion. It doesn't take away, you know, the concern that we as parents would have. But, you know, many states already allow this, and we're just trying to fix a small gap in existing law.
Would your view then be that this isn't depriving parents? In fact, you would encourage that sort of parental involvement. It's rather providing the opportunity for young people who do not have a direct parental relationship, perhaps, to be able to get these sorts of preventative services?
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with what you just said more. And, you know, I would remind people that where young people are getting these services are clinics, physicians, licensed by the state of California. They're private doctor's offices. So while they, in the event that they don't bring someone with them to the clinic, they will have a medical professor or professional who's licensed to help provide that awareness, knowledge, understanding of informed consent to someone even under the age of 18. That already exists in California.
And I guess the other side of that, though, is still the concern, can a 12-year-old really make fully formed decisions? Because even vaccinations can have, though they may well be rare, side effects. Concerns have been raised about any vaccination in that regard, any kind of treatment in that regard. Can a 12-year-old, I guess the question is, really be expected to make a fully informed choice?
Well, I think in a perfect world, all of us would hope that 12-year-olds are not having unprotected intercourse and exposure to sexual activity. But unfortunately, realistically, we know that that is not true. If you look at the Center for Disease Control and their statistics, which is the whole reason I wanted to bring this piece of legislation forward, and you see the growing numbers of young people, fewer at age 12, but they're there, that are being exposed to potentially life-threatening diseases that can impact them and even in some cases kill them. I think you have to weigh the risk and the benefits to having them be available to preventative care with medical professionals who are there to help protect the public health. And, I mean, that's why the California STD Controllers Association, the Health Officers Association of California, have weighed in on this piece of legislation. It's about protecting public health and seeking that balance in order to do that. And if you look at the CDC numbers, increasingly young people exposed to serious STDs, I think we should all be concerned about that.
Assemblymember Toni Atkin, she represents the 76th District in the State Assembly, which includes parts of San Diego. She is the author of Assembly Bill 499, which is the subject of our hour today on Forum. Representative Toni Atkins, Assemblymember Toni Atkins, thanks very much for getting us started in our discussion today.
Thank you.
And joining us now to continue our conversation, Dr. Tonya Chafee. She is an associate clinical professor of pediatrics at the University of California, San Francisco, specializing in adolescent medicine, where she practices at San Francisco General. Dr. Chafee, thanks for being with us this morning.
Thank you very much.
And Bill May joins us as well. He is chairman of Catholics for the Common Good, which is an independent Catholic organization which is opposed to AB 499. Mr. May, thanks for joining us as well.
Good to be with you.
Let's talk about some of the medical aspects of this first, Dr. Chafee, because we haven't really described yet what HPV actually is, what the dangers from it are. Describe what HPV is.
Well, thank you. And I want to just mention that this is an infection that has a long history of research behind it. And I actually want to commend all the people out there who've spent their lives looking at this infection. And it's actually, if you look at it, very fascinating in the sense that it is an infection that is strongly associated with cancer. It's taken decades for us to come to that point. This is a virus that is, as you heard, 1 in 4 adolescents in the United States have an STD, and most of them have HPV right now. It's an infection that's associated with several cancers. We focus a lot right now on cervical cancer because of the vaccines. We're learning more and more about other cancers that this virus is associated with. It's, as you heard, there's different types of the HPV, and I think that's where some people get confused. There's hundreds of types of HPV. 40 of them are transmitted sexually, called anal-genital transmission, and about 20 of those are oncogenic, or the cancer-causing type. And it's those that the research behind vaccine studies have progressed to the extent that we have two vaccines today that are preventing two of the kinds that are associated with the vast majority, particularly of cervical cancer. I do want to mention that there's rectal and anal cancers as well as oral and throat cancers that we're starting to see are associated with HPV.
Now, normally, though, the infection is not something that causes problems. In fact, most of the time people don't even know that they have this particular virus. As high as 90 to 95%, is that correct, wind up not causing any problems at all?
Exactly, and that's the unknown is why. There are definitely risk factors for why people would go on to get cancer once they've gotten infected. Having a normal, healthy immune system is one of those factors. But the big question is, why do some people get cancer and others don't?
And the vaccine would accomplish what? It would completely eliminate, if someone gets the vaccination, does that mean they would never get an HPV and therefore would never be a candidate for cervical cancer that is caused by that particular virus?
So that's a good question. The two vaccines out there right now, there's one that has four serotypes and one that has two serotypes. The one with four serotypes also includes two types of the vaccine that cause genital warts. The other two serotypes, 16 and 18, are the ones that are associated with cervical cancer. There are many other serotypes that also cause cancer, not just cervical cancer. Those are not in the vaccine, so you would not gain 100% protection against the oncogenic serotypes of HPV.
And in the end, what would be gained if there were more widespread usage of this vaccine among young girls in particular? What would that do in terms of the reduction of cervical cancer in particular?
And I'm glad you bring that up. This gets into the issue of vaccines in general. You really have to vaccinate a wide part of the population, up to greater than 90% ideally, in order to get immunity across the population, as well as what we call herd immunity, protecting those who are not already infected. Interestingly, in Australia, they have a policy in place where they allowed all 11 and 12-year-olds to have the vaccine for free. They were able to get above 80% vaccination rates in that country, and that was around 2006, the same time when the U.S. Approved the vaccine. After that, they found in about 2008 and 9, they've already seen a reduction in genital wart, 60% reduction in genital wart infections in their adolescent population. And incidentally, there was a 30% reduction in their boys who were not vaccinated. In our country right now, we're only at about 40% of girls have received even one of the vaccine. Less than 30% have received the whole three series.
And if that vaccination penetrance was greater, cervical cancer rates would come way down?
Absolutely. And they actually already have some ecological evidence in Australia of that. What cervical cancer is it actually is a slow progression. And what we do in this country right now is spend a lot of money on secondary prevention, and that's through Pap screening. Women get Pap screened. The Pap test is not a good screening test. There's problems with false positives and false negatives. We spend around $3 billion a year in this country just following abnormal Pap smears. By reducing the dysplasia, which is basically evidence of HPV infection, it's the end marker. So you mentioned earlier about an unknown infection. One of the ways we know women have been infected is that they have dysplasia on a Pap smear.
Dr. Tonji Chafee, she is Associate Clinical Professor of Pediatrics at UCSF, an adolescent medicine specialist practicing also at San Francisco General. Bill May joins us too, Chairman of Catholics for the Common Good. As you listen to this discussion, Mr. May, I'm sure you also have concerns about this virus from a health standpoint, but your concern primarily is focused on whether or not this should be made available to young girls without parental participation, correct?
Yeah, that's the main issue here. Actually, this bill has two parts of it. One deals with HPV vaccines, and which is very controversial, and we can get into that a little bit. But the other part of it is not controversial, and that has to do with kids that have been exposed to hepatitis B and HIV. And there for those the exposure to hepatitis B would be a vaccination to help prevent the development of the disease and then there's a treatment, as I understand, and doctor is much more knowledgeable on this than me to help prevent the development of full HIV, but it's a 28 day course. And the big problem is that parents have the duty, the responsibility for the health care of their children. And really what this bill does is it takes the parents out of the picture by letting the healthcare providers and the children just work this out themselves without their parents knowing about it. Now, as a parent, I'll tell you, if my child was exposed to HIV or hepatitis B, how they were exposed wouldn't matter as much as making sure that they were aggressively treated. And I don't give up my health care to other people myself. I always pursue that aggressively, and I need to have the right, and I think every other parent needs to have the right to be able to do that on behalf of their child. You know, it's hard to get kids to take their medicine. And to exclude parents from this is just a horrendous thing.
The pushback on that would be, I think, that this doesn't exclude parents so much as it says, if you don't have a relationship with a parent or you don't have the ability to have a conversation with a parent, there's a way you can still get it. In other words, there's nothing in the bill, as I understand it, that says parents can't be involved. It more opens the door for those situations where parents aren't involved.
Now, the way Toni Atkins described it is the way she wished the bill was written rather than the way it's written. Basically, it gives the child consent. It gives the ability for a person to go to the child and say, you know, you can consent to this. You don't have to tell your parent when the child would otherwise, you know, want to tell their parent or have their parent involved. Or even if they don't want their parent involved, it's important for the parent involved just to make sure they take their medicine.
And is it also your concern that a 12-year-old is a 12-year-old and that no matter the situation, even if they are in a situation where they don't have a good parental relationship, that no 12-year-old can really make this sort of informed decision, that a 12-year-old just isn't capable of forming that sort of thoughtful decision-making process?
No, you know, when you think about that, we as adults, you know, we raise questions, we consult with other people in our family, we sometimes want to get a second opinion. You know, anybody who's involved with healthcare today know that we've got to be advocates for ourselves and advocates for our loved ones, and this just takes the people who care most about the well-being of that child out of the picture.
Dr. Tendra Chafee, come back on this point about the importance of involving parents, ideally, but why, in your judgment, sometimes you have to have another way of opening that door.
Well, I would like to say, actually, there is evidence to show that young people can make formed decisions, and the laws are already in place, and we've been able to prove that. And that, yes, absolutely. The law does kind of clarify things, because right now, providers, healthcare providers, have a main goal of doing no harm as well as providing appropriate care. And preventative care is essential to that. Right now, the laws are in place that young people can come to a healthcare provider. They're doing it right now, all the time. We also have, on the other hand, an issue that we know 1 in 4 adolescents are infected with an STD. We need to be able to reach out to those young people. In the best of all possible worlds, every young person would be talking to their parent.
What do you say when a 14-year-old comes into your office at San Francisco General and says, Dr. Chafee, you know, this is my situation, this is what I need? Do you come back with, where's your mom? Where do you go with that?
Absolutely. And I invite anybody to come to clinic this afternoon because I'll be doing exactly that. Yes. We wish that we had the parents involved, and unfortunately, many parents are very busy, so they're not always at the office visit. They're not always in even for the primary care visit. I think another big issue is young people are just learning about the healthcare system. They're learning how to navigate it, and that's actually a developmental milestone for any young person just that's becoming an adult, having an informed discussion with their provider. But it's a triad. Yes, it does involve the parent. They may not physically be there. I think it's important that we do that. Unfortunately, young people don't always involve their parent, and I have an obligation to make sure that this young person's informed and makes a decision about their health.
Describe a situation where that would be true, a typical situation for you where a young girl would come in and not have that sort of parental supervision, that sort of parental involvement. And then I'd like to ask you, Mr. May, to respond to the situation that Dr. Chafee describes.
In my personal practice, I have a lot of young people who are in foster care. So it's unclear who the actual legal guardian is at that moment. And the child may have a very estranged relationship with the family, if none at all. And they may be in a guardianship situation or with a foster care parent. In those situations, and it's interesting to me that many of those young people have grown up fast, and they are already making a lot of informed decisions on their own because they have so many different people in their lives. I spend an extra amount of time making sure the young person knows, particularly around vaccines, because there is another issue that, as we mentioned earlier, this doesn't prevent you from getting cancer. This young person, woman, still needs to get pap tests. But it's also about her reproductive health in the future. I mean, she may want to have children and not have to have 9 million biopsies of her cervix because she had HPV disease. I want to prevent her from any future health consequences. I want her to make an informed decision and to have as much knowledge that she can. And I think that's what we need to do with our young people. And parents should be just as involved as the young people.
Do you make an extra effort, though, in those difficult situations that you're describing with foster kids or kids who don't have an adequate relationship with your parent, to still go out and find those foster parents? What do you do?
Mm-hmm. And it's variable how involved they are. And that's what I often assess from the child, what it is that they feel their relationship is. And sometimes it's not their parent. Sometimes it's, you know, a distant aunt or an uncle or a person at their rec center that they identify who really doesn't have the authority also to make the consent issue. And they are reaching out, and they are, and we know this, young people don't work in a vacuum. That's why they're coming to talk to us, because they want to have that information.
Bill May, chime in on the situation that Dr. Chafee describes, kids who are in foster care, kids who have not had continuous parental involvement in the way we would all ideally want. What do you think should be done in that circumstance?
Well, you know, that is a really serious problem, and it's something that needs to be dealt with in some way, but that's not what this bill does. It doesn't focus on those situations. What this does is it takes away the rights of all parents, the parents who are concerned.
Tell me how it takes away the rights of all parents, because let's say I had a 14-year-old girl. There's nothing in the bill that says I can no longer come and meet with Dr. Chafee.
That's right. But the bill says that your daughter can be offered this or offered other treatment without your parent knowledge. And you know, if the child's embarrassed or whatever, it's an uncomfortable, whatever, you're out of the picture. Now, in a case where your child, your daughter, is exposed to HIV and needs aggressive treatment, wouldn't you want to be on top of that? Wouldn't you want to know? This bill takes you out of that. That's the problem. It's a flawed bill. Good idea. Great vaccine. I mean, the breakthroughs have been tremendous in this area, and there's great hope, and hopefully with more developments down the road, but even, you know, I turned to the Journal for the American Medical Association, one of the most respected journals in medicine. They wrote an editorial on this, saying go slow on this. There's so much that's not known, and one of the key things. Let me just read very, very briefly. Whether a risk is worth taking depends not only on absolute risk, but the relationship between the potential risk and the potential benefit. The net benefit of HPV vaccine to a woman is uncertain for a lot of reasons.
Let me just hold you there, because we're about to go into a break, and we'll pick up on the various concerns. And Dr. Chafee, I'll ask you to respond to that as well about what the benefits are, because one of the arguments that people have made is that the cervical cancer rates in this country are low. Therefore, the amount of energy and time and money we spend on this could be better spent in other ways. Lots of issues that we still have to contend with. And we'll also take up more fully this question of parental involvement and whether or not this bill prevents that or not, and in what situations can kids who are without adequate parental relationships get the help that we need. We'll dig into all of that when we return. Here's our number. We'd like you to join our conversation at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our topic this hour, the vaccine to prevent HPV, that's human papilloma virus. It's gotten a lot of attention in some of the Republican presidential debates, including the one last night. But it's also an issue here in California. Assembly Bill 499 is now sitting on Governor Jerry Brown's desk. It would allow minors, children as young as 12, to receive vaccines for HPV as well as hepatitis B. be without parental consent. And that's the topic we're focusing on during this part of Forum. Joining us, Dr. Tonya Chafee. She is Associate Clinical Professor of Pediatrics, also practices adolescent medicine at San Francisco General, and Bill May, Chairman of Catholics for the Common Good, an organization which is opposed to this particular bill. We welcome your participation in our conversation too. 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org or post your comments on our Facebook page. Before the break, Bill May, you were just describing what you think are some of the health concerns, I believe, about the HPV vaccine in particular. Go ahead, if you would, please finish your thought, and I'll get Dr. Chafee to respond.
Sure, sure. I was just quoting an editorial from the Journal of the American Medical Association that's cautioning. Actually, both of the major journals have cautioned going slow on this vaccine, but this particular quote dealt with the risk benefit, and it said the net benefit of HPV vaccine to a woman is uncertain. Even if persistently infected with HPV, a woman most likely will not develop cancer if she is regularly screened. When weighing evidence about risks and benefits, it is also appropriate to ask who takes the risk and who gets the benefit, and that's the real problem here. It's the child that's taking the risk and the benefit, and a 12-year-old cannot evaluate this. In fact, there is no protection in this bill against coercion of the child to get them to take it.
Let's split the question, if we might, and talk first about the benefits, because it is an argument that is made and deserves our best answer, which is, again, that 90% of people who are infected with HPV don't wind up getting cancer. Cancer, cervical cancer rates in this country are small. There are other ways to screen, pap smears, which you described before, that this isn't necessarily where we ought to be focused with our healthcare dollars.
I would actually disagree, because I think from a public health perspective, one of the biggest benefits that we've ever seen, inventions, have been the vaccine. And this is another example of that. The cost of this particular vaccine is a lot, but as I mentioned, in other countries, there's more than 100 countries that are you know, using the HPV vaccine that have national healthcare systems, and they understand the cost benefit of this.
And the cost, by the way, is $400, something like
that? For the whole three series, a little bit more than that. And the issue is that we spend an inordinate amount of money with the pap smear, which is not a great test, but it's the only way to effectively screen for cervical cancer at this point. And we don't even have really screening methods for other types of cancers that this vaccine is associated with. I don't even think we know right now. I think this is a to-be-continued conversation of the benefits of this vaccine, knowing the other cancers that are associated with HPV.
So you'd also make an economic argument that
absolutely.
That with most, as with most things, preventive, if you can do that now, it's money well spent.
Yeah, and then the idea of herd immunity. You're going to be protecting other people who didn't get the vaccine if we can get people vaccinated.
Let's hear what our listeners think of this topic. Lori joins us first. Lori, go ahead, please.
Hi. I'm wondering if HPV is sexually transmitted. Why are boys not getting vaccinated?
Fair question. Lori, Dr. Chafee?
Actually, right now, boys are being vaccinated in the United States, and for two reasons. The first reason that the boys were added was because our vaccine rates are so poor for girls, and was able to sort of help increase the vaccine rates in the whole population. We have a precedence, too, because with the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, women who got rubella were the ones that had the infection in pregnancy and had the you know, awful disease of rubella during pregnancy. And men were vaccinated to prevent giving that and getting a rubella infection to their wives or their partners. With the more recent thing, like I mentioned, there's other cancers that we're seeing that are not just reproductive organs of the woman. And that's important, I think, for young men to know about, that they also can get some benefits from this vaccine.
Lori, thanks for the call. Let's hear next from Marna in San Francisco. Marna, go ahead.
Hi. Yeah. I'm interested to know what the or who is funding the vaccine, because a lot of times the push to get a vaccine out there is not necessarily motivated by public health concerns. And it seems that with the way the bill is currently written, for it to just be out there for anyone to get, it must be getting some kind of, you know, large funding from companies that are interested in getting the vaccine out there, not only for testing purposes, but also, you know, for profit. So I'm interested to know who is funding the vaccine and how that's going to work. And I can take my answer off the air. Thank you very much. I love the show.
Marna, thanks. Thanks for the call. This is a question, Bill May, that's gotten some attention, too, about the role of pharmaceutical companies, Merck in particular, which is the maker of the most widely distributed vaccine.
Well, both the New England Journal of Medicine and the Journal of American Medical Association have both been critical in editorials about Merck in particular's marketing strategy on this, and the fact that they've been funding a lot of professional medical organizations to go out and promote this. In fact, those programs were in place even before the trials were completed. On this. So that's been very, very controversial, and we're hearing all about the cronyism in Texas and how it got Perry in trouble. But this is something that's been well established across the country, and have been actually editorialized by the two most prestigious journals in the country.
It's a fair point, Dr. Chafee. Would you acknowledge that the role that pharmaceutical companies play in promoting getting their particular, whether it be a drug or a vaccine used, is something that physicians are indeed affected by?
It is pervasive, I will say that. But regarding this particular vaccine, it's been looked at. And getting back to the cost, it's for young people today, it's covered on many, many insurance plans. They understand the importance of this. As a health plan, they probably like, okay, if we're going to spend money on something, let's prevent this rather than deal with the cost of treatment later on. Vaccine for Children, which is the federal program that funds a lot of vaccines, have included this particular vaccine as part of their program.
But on the question of the role of Merck and pharmaceutical companies lobbying, whether it's doctors or the legislature, that's a problem.
It goes both ways, though. There's the argument that the industries that do PAP testing could also be lobbying. I mean, it does go both ways. It's. I think society in general is sort of inundated by corporations.
Sarah in San Francisco has our next question. Sarah, go ahead.
Hi, I just have a comment. I'm a young woman who has contracted high-risk HPV. I've had to go through numerous PAP screenings, biopsies, had to have a leak procedure done. And I wish that when I was growing up, there was a vaccine. I mean, the cost and time and money and to my insurance that's happening now, it's like this all could have hopefully been avoided. And hopefully for lots of young women can be.
And Sarah, just so that I understand your situation, you're talking about a variety of problems you've had to contend with because of an HPV infection that aren't about cancer. So there are – is the point you're making that there are lots of other things that can happen?
There are lots of other things that can happen because of this. It's not about cancer at this point. It's everything to be done to prevent the cancer. But in the meantime, there's routine screenings and there's biopsies that are very uncomfortable and a whole host of other issues that I know is costing my insurance a lot of money.
Sarah, thanks. Thanks for the observation. Let's go next to Lisa in Palo Alto. Lisa, go ahead, please.
Thank you very much. Dr. Jaffe's point's persuasive. Clearly, this seems like a useful thing. But I'm wondering what the real impact will be on the average teenager who, you know, independently is going to be thinking 20 or 30 years down the road, make an appointment, get herself to the doctor's office to get a shot in the arm, you know, and then pay for it. And the average teenager can't keep track of their homework assignments for tomorrow. I'm almost wondering if Texas was ahead of us on this and requiring, if this really does save lives and requiring that girls get vaccinated.
Lisa, thanks for the observation. Bill May, you want to respond?
Well, that's precisely my point, particularly in the areas where a child's been exposed to HIV or hepatitis B. Those are not controversial, it's very clear what the treatment is on that. And as a parent, we need to be on top of it. I mean, it is hard to get your kids to do their homework, you know, when they're teenagers and remember to do things they should. It's hard, you know, when they're sick and Dr. Chafee provides a prescription for them, it's work for the parents to make sure those kids take those medications on time. Now, if they don't have that kind of support and supervision on that, if the parent doesn't even know about it, how can they be assured that they're, you know, I mean, this is just a prescription for disaster. What are the health consequences of that? No studies have been done on that at all.
But here's my question, I guess, in response. Are the dangers that you just described greater than the problems that we just heard Sarah describe if you have HPV?
Well, that's a really good question because no one can say, or I guess the doctor could say, that her problem was caused by one of the HPVs that is covered by this vaccine. There's a good chance that it wasn't. So that's one of the misnomers. As Dr. Chafee said, these vaccines do not prevent cervical cancer. They prevent some of the two of the viruses that can cause that.
But as I understand it, the estimates are, and again, we should note, you were mentioning JAMA and others, the Journal of American Medicine and others have raised concerns. In fairness, we should also acknowledge that the use of this vaccine has been endorsed by the California State Department of Health, by the Center for Disease Control, and by the American Academy of Pediatrics. And as I understand the statistics, correct me if I'm wrong, use of this vaccine would reduce cervical cancer by 70%.
Yes. And I would like to clarify, yes, this will be a cancer prevention vaccine. That's the whole point of this. But as the caller said, and I have that conversation quite frequently of young women who have cervical disease and find out about the vaccine and wish that they had gotten it. And so I look at that and go, I have young people right now. I don't want to say to them 10 years from now, it didn't happen. We didn't get you the vaccine for whatever reason.
I mean, our point of agreement here, correct me if I'm wrong, Bill May, is that preventing HPV infections would be a good thing. I mean, no one is arguing for not having a vaccine.
Absolutely.
You're not opposed to the vaccine. You're opposed to something that would make it easy for kids to get this without involving their parents.
I also want to clarify the legislation, though, because it's just adding on a little part of what is already happening. And the discussion that the legislator mentioned earlier is that young people are already seeking services. They're already making informed decisions about a lot of different things, including pregnancy, including rape, including substance abuse. Those laws are on the book.
And I think this Mr. May would argue that that's not a good thing, correct?
Just because it's happening doesn't mean they're making informed decisions. That's a huge leap. There's been no research on that and the ability of children to make informed decisions on complex things. But this bill is so flawed from a public health standpoint. There's a study at Harvard that said it's only cost effective to vaccinate 11 to 12 year olds. It's not cost effective for older women. This bill includes providing it to boys at public expense, even though the Center for Disease Control doesn't recommend it for boys.
Let me let Dr. Chafee respond, and then I want to get to more calls. Go ahead.
So, yes, they have looked at this, and there is evidence that vaccinating boys will be cost effective. And again, it's because of where we are right now. We have such low rates in our country. We have to somehow get more and more young people vaccinated. Even our 11
by
to
low
12
rates, low rates of
low
vaccination.
Rates, like under 40% with all three. And that's another challenge of this particular vaccine is it requires three visits or three opportunities to vaccinate. It's not just one shot.
Robert wants to return to the question of parental involvement. Let's hear from him next in Santa Cruz. Robert, go ahead.
I had 2 points. I don't buy the argument that access to prevention is the same as access to treatment. If a child were to contract gonorrhea, it's not like the parent could refuse to allow them to have treatment. So in that case, we allow them to have treatment. Prevention is completely different. The other point that I'd like to, or question or topic I'd like to hear discussed is, why is no one talking about the possibility of a child having a very close relationship with their parent? They make a mistake, and they're too afraid to discuss it with their parent.
Mm-hmm. Robert, thanks. Thanks for the observation. Do you run into that, Dr. Chafee?
Absolutely. And I actually really commend young people who do have close relationships. And I'm actually in the situation often of having the conversation in a difficult situation, say if a young person's pregnant or does have an STD, and they the first thing I want to know is, who are you going to talk to about this? And we often bring the parent in, have a parent conversation about that. This is not, it's the legislation is helping providers really address the issue of those that don't have that relationship. That's already there. And we know we can't legislate parental communication. And I want to just say that the Supreme Court has actually already ruled on that from the other legislations that's been passed at the state level.
Number of emails coming in. Faye writes, do condoms prevent HPV exposure? That would be the obvious, she says, preventative measure.
Yeah, and I want to address the caller's other point that we are already doing prevention to some extent whenever a young person does come in, and condoms is another part of that. With HPV, it's not 100%. This is usually a kind of a skin-to-skin type of transmission. And unless you had a whole body latex, you really wouldn't be able to completely prevent HPV transmission with a condom.
I'm wondering about the association of HPV with oral cancers in young women. Since teens sometimes think that oral sex is not sex, there's a lot more oral genital contact in adolescence than in prior generations.
Yeah, this is a whole other area of research looking at HPV transmission. The vast majority is from coital sex, so I'll just label it that. But we are seeing high-risk HPV types. There's been some studies already looking at the high-risk serotypes in the oral and pharyngeal. And as I mentioned earlier, the ENT or the ear, nose, throat discipline is looking at this aggressively because we're seeing more and more HPV-associated oral pharyngeal cancers, which are actually on the rise in this country, as well as rectal and anal cancers.
Allie writes in, what about education? Is HPV and its serious potential risks addressed in health education? As a young adult in college in the 90s, I was barely aware of how serious HPV was. Many of my peers had it. One of my classmates left school early because she had cervical cancer, and goes on to talk more about that. Do you feel, Bill May, as someone who has concerns about this legislation, that more ought be done in terms of education?
Oh, absolutely. Education is really, really important for young people and for parents. Dr. Chafee and I were talking about that in the green room. Much more has to be done on this, but the problem with this bill this bill doesn't deal with education. This really deals with taking away the parents' rights to manage the health care for their kids, particularly kids that have been exposed to HIV and hepatitis B. And you know, we get hung up on these controversial things like the HPV vaccine, but this bill is much broader than that. And kids need the parental involvement.
Let me ask Dr. Chafee to respond to that, because we keep circling back to that question about whether or not this bill deprives parents of their rights.
I disagree. I really feel that things are already in place. And if anything, it's allowing the opportunity to prevent not just HPV, but a lot of the other infections. And when a person does come in for, say, gonorrhea treatment, the provider is going to talk about all the other things that they're at risk for, pregnancy, other STDs. And that's what's so important. It's already happening as we speak. This legislation would allow us to have a discussion with the young person. And I think, you know, we talk about the 12-year-old, but it's really 6 years, 12 to 18, that we're talking about. Young people go from being really completely dependent on adults for decision making to being completely independent. And as healthcare providers, that's our role, is to really work with young people to understand it. I do think, and I'm so glad this forum session's happening, education of everybody needs to happen. This is an area that the technology and the medical information is just leaps and bounds. And the questions, I get these questions all the time. I speak on this all the time because I think we aren't informed. And so we're afraid of things we don't know. And once you know, I think the answers become more simplistic.
Kay writes in again about the money part of this. One of the things I'd like to see discussed is the allegation that California legislatures have been bankrolled on this by Merck. Again, that's the pharmaceutical company that makes this particular vaccine. Does the doctor from UCSF have any relationship with Merck or other vaccine manufacturers?
Full disclosure, I do. But I also speak on behalf of the city and county of San Francisco, on behalf of UCSF. And I talk all over about this because I know that the information that's out there often is not clear, and people are making decisions. Parents sometimes are not making informed decisions on behalf of their young child, and that's something that I have to have a long discussion with. I would speak to parents' groups as well, because I do think the information that's out there is very confusing, and you can tell by the caller's questions there's a lot we don't know.
And Bill May, on, again, this question of parental rights, come back on this point that there's nothing in the bill that says parents can't come in. It just says that kids can come in without them if need be.
It says the parents aren't needed anymore in these kinds of decisions. That's what the bill says. And there's no protection in there for
I wish I had the bill in front of me, but it says, there's actual language that says parents are not needed?
By saying that all that is needed is the child's consent, a 12-year-old's consent. For treatment, and then the responsibility for the health care is then up to the child without the parental involvement. And I'll tell you, if my kid's exposed to HIV, I want to be involved to make sure they take their medicine on time.
Dr. Chafee, on
there
that
are there are laws in place around any immediate harm to a child and actually a child hurting themselves. There are laws in place when a young person discloses those things that a healthcare provider does have to notify people. But again, I know we're going in circles. This doesn't really change what's already in place. It just adds another realm of primary prevention. And from a public health perspective, I think young people are have a lot of missed opportunities for preventing something that we know and you've heard from callers suffer later on.
Dr. Tanya Chafee, Associate Clinical Professor of Pediatrics, who's joined us along with Bill May, Chairman of Catholics for the Common Good. You've been listening to Forum. This is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Dave Iverson. And let's take another call. Luciano joins us from New York City this morning. Luciano, go ahead.
Yes, hi. I'm a physician in New York City, and my father was a physician also. We come from I'd like to just illuminate a little bit about the disease. I'm sure the professors there know, but I'm not sure the public quite understands the burden and the abhorrent disease that this is in its late stages.
Are you referring now to cervical cancer or to just...
Specifically to cervical cancer. I trained at a city hospital here, and so we saw some third world. And just horrific end of life with lost kidneys and ureters and frozen pelvis. And this is not a, it's a very emotional thing. I know both my dad was a researcher in this, and me, it was very gut-wrenching, even though we're scientists and so on. So from my perspective as someone who's seen people like this, die of this, this should be approved and go ahead.
Luciano, thanks. Thanks for adding your perspective and reminder on what cervical cancer can be like. Appreciate your point of view and your perspective on our program. Bill May?
That really has nothing to do with this discussion, because this vaccine does not prevent cervical cancer. It prevents two strains of a virus that are known to cause cervical cancer. So to make that leap and put in the people's mind that this is the prevention for cervical cancer, it's not.
I have to say I'm missing how that's a leap. If you eliminate something that causes cancer, then you are reducing the possibility of that cancer occurring. According to the statistics that I have read, if this vaccine were more widely spread, and I'm not advocating, I'm just saying that's the facts, it would reduce cancer rates by 70%. So why is that a leap?
Actually, not so. Going back to the New England Journal of Medicine and JAMA, they're not going to know what the effect of this is going to be for 20, 40 years on cervical cancer. In fact, it's very, very interesting. In some of the trials, it showed that with women who had had this virus that there was an increasing trend of precancerous lesions caused by HPV serotypes other than the ones covered by the vaccine.
There's just so much that's unknown about this so far.
But to
paint a picture of someone with terminal cervical cancer when there are so many ways of catching it early, as I understand, Doctor, and you can elaborate on that.
Yeah.
And preventing it through through regular screening,
Dr. Chafee,
really
go ahead.
Distorts the whole issue here.
So yeah, we do have screening measures, but I want to remind everybody the screening techniques that we have right now cost a lot of money and they're not very effective. I mean, it requires follow-up exams because of the issue of false negatives. And false positives.
Are you recommending that people not do these screenings if they have the vaccine?
That, but I know that we will start to initially see, as we're already showing evidence in Australia, decreased evidence of dysplasia, which means you've been infected with HPV, and that has to be followed.
Let me just ask if you can verify, Dr. Chafee, the statistic that I offered, mm-hmm. which is that, as I understand it, this vaccination would reduce cervical cancer rates by 70%. Is that correct?
Correct, because 16 and 18 are associated with about 80% of cervical cancer worldwide.
All right, and we'll now go to Jeff in Missouri. Jeff, go ahead, please.
Hi, I appreciate your time. I in certain aspects, I do agree with the gentleman from the Catholic Coalition. I don't think that this bill is designed to do what he's saying that it's doing. Other, more appropriately, that it's an unforeseen consequence that could occur based on this bill. And my preference, who is a huge advocate of the vaccine, I have two daughters myself, or the vaccine, I have two daughters myself, my preference would be that it's something that is mandated, like any other vaccine. The quicker we can get it to a point where people understand that it's something that we should do completely, then I would rather have it something that we have to take, and it's mandated, as opposed to, as the gentleman is saying, opening up this opportunity as a very informed parent, the opportunity for my kids to do something without my consent. And I completely understand the doctor's concerns. There are a lot of opportunities that can be missed there. But my concern is that this unintended consequence of a very positive, motivated thing that the gentleman is referring to, and I think that's the appropriate way to put it, it's an unintended consequence. It's not the purpose of the bill.
Jeff, thanks for the observation. It's a useful point. Just have 10 seconds each. Last quick thought, Bill May, please.
I think that's a great point he made. There's a lot of unintended consequences with this bill, and it ought to be vetoed.
Dr. Chafee.
I would just like to add that when this legislation, the minor rights to consent for care, was written, it didn't have the new things that we have and the new technologies that we have to prevent infections. And this is just supplementing that legislation that's already in place in our state.
And we'll have to leave it there, Dr. Tanja Chafee. Bill May, thanks very much for joining us today. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.